At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Art of Craftsmanship podcast. My name is Dustin O'Hara, and I'm here with my brother and co-host, Devin.
Hello.
And we're also joined by our guest today, Ben Wheaton.
Hi, everyone.
All right, Dev, what do you got for us today for a quote?
I speak Spanish to God, Italian to women, French to men, and German to my horse.
So Ben, I always like to try to.
Okay, Dust. Actually, we'll let Ben try to guess the person that might have said that.
All right.
The quote is familiar. I just can't think of who it is.
I'll say,
some Prussian.
No, guess the nationality. Not Prussia.
So he said Spanish.
Spanish to God, Italian to women, French to men. And German to my horse.
Is he Spanish?
No, he's French.
Because he speaks Spanish to God. He's French?
Yeah. He's a king. I guess they could, any king could say that, really. King Charles V of France. Now, he said that. Now, Ben, I want to ask you. At first, it just seems like a funny slight towards Germans, right? But then it seems as if, then I was also thinking, you do teach a lot of animals commands in German. So I guess maybe you could teach a horse, but I think it's more of a slight towards them. Weren't the French more, I guess it depends when, but they didn't say anything about the English. Why do you think that is?
Well, if this is Charles V, mm-hmm. then he would have been at war with the English.
Right.
In which case, you don't really want to, I guess, speak to them. English wasn't really a prestige language. Most of the time, most of the English people whom Charles V would have dealt with would have been speaking French. Mm. Because the English aristocracy did not speak English. They spoke French back in the day.
Oh, that's crazy.
This is why we have you here. So, did they also not like the Germans at the time?
Well, you know, lower class. You know, German wasn't really considered a high class language.
There you go.
I was thinking though, actually, when you were saying the quote, Devin, I was thinking like, you know, your horse, I guess, to like a cavalry. Men, I would imagine the horse would be, you know, obviously a prized possession for a king. You know, they had obviously any horse they want, as right. many as they wanted, and rode whoever they wanted. They still, you know, with like hunting and things like that, you know, those recreational sports. But I would be like, oh, if that was not a necessarily king, then maybe the horse is the one that you actually treat like your best friend and your most respected companion.
Right.
But
no, I thought that was kind of funny. Yeah. A good jab at the Germans, that's I great. Guess. So yeah, I think that's a good, well, not a good segue yet. I'm going to say, so all these language, these close countries in Europe, for so long, there was these battles, right? On things changed on who was, to make it simple, the most popular. So the languages would switch, and I guess there was always Latin thrown in there. Right. What was the lowest form of languages? Was it English and German and those type of things for a while?
Well, I mean, all languages. I mean, like in general, depends which period of the Middle Ages you were in.
Right.
You were in early Middle Ages, you always spoke Latin. Because French, of course, came out of Latin as sort of the language of the common people, from vulgar Latin, which is what they used to speak. And same thing with modern Italian and Spanish. But on the whole, you speak, French, I mean, because France was always the most powerful kingdom and in the West until the 19th century. And so French was always the most sort of prestigious language. Again, it was spoken by the English nobility. And, so the Crusaders, the common language of all the Crusaders was French. And the same thing goes with, the language of learning too. So at Oxford University in the 13th century, you have the students being taught first French before they learn Latin.
Oh wow, that's crazy. I didn't realize that.
And was that mainly mainly at the time a power thing or a commerce thing?
Both. Yeah. Really. I mean, French was just had more prestige. It was the language of the aristocracy. Right. And I mean, at least aristocracy around that. Obviously, in France, it was also the language of the people. But
now, there's a lot of good reasons the French were so powerful for so long. But there's also, don't you think it was just a good spot geographically, right? They can kind of mingle with everybody?
Well, I mean, certainly, I'm not sure I'd say that. I would say just that they were always a unified, fairly unified kingdom and populous kingdom. So, you know, you've been the wealthiest for a long time.
Right.
So, because, you know, they had, you know, so they were the longest continuity. They're all sort of one political entity from the time of the fall of Rome onward, really. So.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. You think of all the history and strife the English had and the United Kingdom had. Obviously, they weren't united at the time, but constantly battling back and forth. Everyone's close. I guess, yeah, that's a power move.
Yeah. Well, also the Norman conquered, England in, you know, in 1066 with William the Conqueror, and, they all spoke French.
So, there you have it. And, well, yeah, why don't we,
go ahead.
Sorry. I was going to say this. Why don't you introduce who this wealth of knowledge is?
Right. So, our guest today is our cousin, Ben Wheaton. And Ben is our cousin on my mom's side. My mom's sister, Jackie, is Ben's mom. And so we are first cousins. Ben he's been studying medieval history for quite a long time. I've always been fascinated with the way, like, your mind works, Ben, because you, like, you love that stuff, and you can remember all the details, and, you know, and that's obviously, I think, all of us, when there's something that we're interested in, you just naturally will, like, fall to that thing, and that's, like, the way I've always been about art and making, and, you know, I can remember a painting that I saw when I was 18 in a gallery. And I might not be remember like the dates when it exactly happened, but I can remember what it looked like. All that stuff just sticks in my head.
And
your background,
and then Ben will tell you who's fighting in that painting.
Right, exactly.
Oh, what the battle was.
These two. Yeah, exactly. Right. Ben's his PhD is in medieval studies. He studied Europe in late antiquity, and he's a historian of the early Middle Ages. So, Ben, can you just tell us a little bit about your history and how you got into medieval studies and what your education is and where things are going for you?
Well, I got into medieval studies. So I studied I did my master's and my PhD at the University of Toronto. I got into it because I didn't have any Greek. And I initially actually wanted to do classics, but Greek and Roman, history of Greece and Rome. But I didn't have any Greek. And so the next best thing would be to go do medieval studies, because all you needed was Latin, a little bit of Latin, so I could do that. So that's kind of the initial story about how I got into it. But actually, what I wanted to do was I wanted to study, because I've always been into history. I've always liked history. But I figured I didn't know anything whatsoever about the period just after the fall of Rome. And so I figured the best way to learn about that period would be to do a PhD in it. And so that's eventually how I ended up doing it. And so I got into, do my master's and PhD at the University of Toronto. And then actually last year I went to Italy for a postdoctoral research fellowship to Florence to do work there. So traveling around, looking at old manuscripts, old books that were written in the Middle Ages. Oh, wow. Some of them are 1,500 years old.
Jeez.
And so, and then this year, I've been writing a number of writing projects engaged in.
Yeah, that's you saying that you wanted to learn about that part of history, so you got a PhD, is like saying, I cut my arm, so I want to become a doctor to figure out how to fix it.
There you go.
You went all the way. You're like, all right, I'm going to do as far as I can go. Now, I want to, because do you think being Canadian made you a little bit more interested in that part of history? I mean, everyone, I would assume, around the world, and definitely in the Americas, we're all interested in knights and all that stuff and battles. It's all pretty much all boys, you would think, and girls can be, but are interested in that stuff. But do you think being Canadian, having a little bit of that English connection, got you more interested in it?
Well, being a subject of Queen Elizabeth, who's the descendant of King Alfred, certainly it doesn't get in the way. I wouldn't say any more so, though. I mean, there isn't that much medieval studies going on at Canadian universities. There's some, I mean, as much as there is in American universities.
Yeah.
Not necessarily. I mean, it's still very much a New World area. And so if you go to Europe, for example, there is a lot more sort of, I guess, professional activity around it.
Right.
I remember being, I was in the UK for an exchange during my undergraduate and during my bachelor's degree. And I remember being in a farmhouse that some guy had bought and was renovating. And, he had these big old flagstones on the floor of the dining room. And I'm like, so you're going to, put hardwood over this or laminate or some such thing. And he says, they've lasted since 1600, so they should last another few hundred years. I'm like, oh, right. This is actual old.
Right. So unfinished old building. When are you going to knock this thing down, put in a nice apartment complex up?
Hey, exactly.
Get some AC.
Plastics.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I will say one thing about the English. They do not like air conditioning. Or maybe we're just used to it everywhere.
They don't. So the same across Europe. And I was in Italy as well. I made sure to get an apartment with aircon.
Right.
But most don't have it.
Those tea and scones are tough to enjoy when it's 90 degrees.
We think like they have a lot of moderate weather,
Right.
Yeah. It doesn't get as UK is nice,
but I guess they just learned to live with it. And we've been, we haven't.
Well, yeah, I haven't.
We have the technology.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially like with our temp, the temperature and the here in Maryland, we have really humid air all throughout the summer.
That's so true.
You know, right on the coast of the Chesapeake Bay here, where it's really, really humid, and that's what is a real killer in the summer for me. It's like I could deal with the heat,
right,
but it's so humid that you just like feel sticky and like sweaty and gross and.
Right.
Yeah.
So, Ben, what? So you're talking about going to Italy and not finding, but getting to look at these manuscripts. Mm-hmm. Did you go into museums? Do they pull them out? Do you get to like touch them with gloves on, or do you just kind of go to museums and look around?
All right. Well, this is sort of the hands-on stuff that I do. Mm-hmm. Most of my research I do with just, you know, texts that I've already, right. So I just read books and, you know, and do stuff. But the hands-on stuff I do is looking at these old manuscripts. And you don't actually go to a museum because they're usually not held in museums. They're held in libraries, particularly libraries of cathedrals.
Right.
Or I was, so 5 years ago, I went to Italy on a research trip with actually my brother, Mark. He and I went, he didn't come with me to the libraries, but we both went together, and I actually went to the Vatican Library.
Nice.
That's awesome.
I was able to go in. So basically, if you have a letter of introduction from your university or your employer of some kind, they will let you in. And if you have, you know, saying this person is trained to deal with manuscripts, then they'll let you in. So what you do is you go in, in some of the smaller cathedrals, it's very informal. You just go in, you have to contact them ahead of time, say, you know, make an appointment to come in and see them.
Right.
And then they bring the books to you. Mm. And then, you wear gloves and you just go through them. So
are you, the majority of what you're looking at, is that written in Latin?
Yep. It's all in Latin.
Okay. Wow.
How good's your Latin?
It's good.
That's great.
Yeah. One of the things that the University of Toronto really prides itself in is the fact that they're fanatics in making sure that their graduates know Latin. Like, not the whole University of Toronto, but the medieval studies program that I was in is sort of obsessive about learning Latin really well. So we do that very well. Yeah, so it's all Latin. But we also do a lot of stuff, what's called paleography, which is looking at really old, which is the reading of old writing.
Oh, cool.
So that's any, that's
old as in just like purely age, or also, I guess, you know, I guess you have to
old language.
Decipher some stuff.
That's old languages, but the actual writing itself.
Old.
So you go in. So if you were to look at an actual manuscript with, say, Virgil's Aeneid, or a history of the middle, or history, say, of the Battle of Agincourt, you wouldn't, it would be hard for a modern person to read it because, I mean, it's written in Latin using our alphabet, but the way you form the letters is very different.
Right.
So, and they use a lot of tons of abbreviations that are unfamiliar to us. And basically, so you look at a text and you have to figure out, okay, I mean, some texts, some scripts, remember, it's all handwritten. It's all and it's all calligraphy, as we would call it.
Hmm.
And so the way you form a letter is different from we would do it sometimes. So, and they would use abbreviations that don't always make a lot of sense to us.
Right.
So
now was that like, is that using abbreviations, would that be based on a time period? Like everyone from a time period would use the same ones?
That's or exactly right.
Different.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So basically, like, so it depends upon where you are and what time period. Yeah, exactly. So we think of, have you ever heard of Gothic lettering?
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's sort of what most people think of when they think of medieval writing, they think of Gothic lettering. That's actually from the later Middle Ages. And what's interesting about it is it's also the most complicated form of handwriting with the most abbreviations. Mm-hmm. And so actually when people in the Renaissance were trying to read this old stuff, they didn't like it. So they called it Gothic because, you know, it's like barbarian kind of stuff. But actually, it's the most advanced handwriting. The stuff they really liked and they called Roman handwriting because they thought, oh, this must have been written by the ancient Romans because it's so nice and clear. It's basically the same kind of thing we used to, kind of writing we use today, actually. It was actually written during the time of Charlemagne.
Right. So it's Right, the Renaissance, they wanted to go back to a time before. I guess that's why you get a lot of, I mean, there was plenty of negative things to happen, but the Renaissance tried to move past that and go back to, right, they really liked the Greeks and the Romans, right?
That's right, yeah. Exactly. Mm. Well, yeah. And so, but so that's kind of how we have the Middle Ages between the, you know, classical period and the Renaissance. But again, the Middle Ages liked the Greeks and Romans a lot too.
Right.
So,
I was, good old YouTube. I was watching a bunch of different stuff a few weeks ago. And the fact, I guess, Dust, you'll know, and Ben, that all these, what we think is this kind of classical style of white marble statues was, most of them apparently were painted. Mm-hmm. So even now we do the marble and we don't paint it, right? You have the Lincoln Memorial in D.C. as in a lot of white marble things probably should have been painted, but we don't see it like that. We don't. That's
I guess you could say it's neoclassical. It's not actually classical.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So, but yeah, it was painted. But I mean, and the same thing, you know, because you see old architecture, and you know, you want it to look pretty, so you give it lots of different colors.
Right.
You go to, so in Florence, for example, that you have massive, you've got this massive medieval cathedral. And it's got all kinds of multicolored stone and paint all over the outside. It's really quite beautiful.
Yeah, and the inside of castle walls too, right? Mm-hmm. Now we think of this bare stone, this cold stone, but a lot of times they'd flatten that and make nice walls and plaster over it and paint it.
Yep.
Real nice decorative touches, you know, depending on the room, obviously. But a princess or the royalty, they weren't necessarily staying in a dungeonous looking room all the time.
Oh no, there'd be carpets and tapestries and painted stuff and fireplaces. Oh yeah,
right. So when you're, I was, so going back to like reading manuscripts and things, when you're doing that, are you looking, are you going specifically to find out more about the history or like information about someone's specific life or a combination of any of it, just based on the time period?
I am looking at the actual text itself. So basically, okay, most of the manuscripts I've been looking at have stuff written in them that's already been printed.
Gotcha.
So they're not texts that, so if I want to go find out about some historical subject or person, I will go to a modern printed book.
Right. Gotcha.
Because, I mean, they're easier to read, you know, and plus they've been edited that, you know, to make them more understandable and other stuff on it. So going to an actual manuscript is just a lot of work.
Right.
And
right,
you don't have that much time. So you have to go to it. But I looked at it, so I want to find out, like, specific, because the thing about handwritten books is that every single one is different, because no scribe is going to be perfect. They're going to make mistakes, and they're going to make different mistakes. So I go to these old manuscripts to write down what this particular scribe in this particular book wrote down, like the exact words, and then look and compare it with other words, with other manuscripts to see, you know, how it differs, and that sort of thing. So.
Right, and I would think just as an artist like Dustin would actually want to go and see the painting, and be close to it,
right,
and you can actually put your hands on the manuscript. There's something in that too. You just want to be near and be where the person was, and know that they were here, and this is their ink on paper, or their paint on a canvas. Right. It's the same thing. You can't just sit. I mean, we could Google it and probably find it, because the books you're looking at or the scrolls you're looking at, they're not newly discovered. That they've been, like you said, translated, but you want to really get your hands and eyes on it.
Exactly, yeah. And they're all books, by the way, no scribe, no scrolls.
Okay,
no
that's scrolls. Is that way older?
Yeah, well, scrolls, yeah, they're way older. So basically what happened is, it's actually quite interesting, scrolls were popular in the classical period, but then what happened is with the sort of the later Roman Empire, like in the 400s and 500s, books or codexes, they're called books, mm-hmm, what we think of today, came into fashion. And so they're most books. So most of the texts we have are not scrolls, but codexes. So, or books.
Gotcha.
Go ahead. And it came in particular because, especially heavily, Christians used codexes for most of the time. Even preferred codexes to scrolls even before the end of the Roman Empire. And so as Christianity became more dominant, codexes just became more popular, especially. But it's just a change in fashion, or we don't exactly know all the reasons exactly why, but we just know that these came more to fashion here. So we have stuff.
Yeah, I would imagine, you know, just as purely as like a maker, got to think eventually, you know, you get to, you're always innovating. People are always innovating and trying to come up with something that's better or something that's easier or something that like works, you know, more efficiently in what they're doing. And so you can imagine that a book would be able to, you know, you don't have to piece together long pieces of things, right? You can do individual pages.
And you can write comments on them.
Yeah. And you can work, you know, probably put more pages in or take pages out.
That's right.
You can kind of build this codex as it were.
And I mean, how else are you going to use a bookmark if you know, bookmark and a scroll is kind of tough.
Exactly.
Yep. And the 100th time when you're finishing up your work and the front rolls away down into the puddles,
you have
to chase it down the street. Oh, that's it. We need something else.
Man.
Yep.
Exactly. Innovated. I was interested again. So when you're looking, you're going through like a manuscript or a codex and looking for information, and you're looking at the way that person wrote, specifically their handwriting, what they did. Are you looking for possible differences in different people's accounts of the same thing?
Sometimes yes. Sometimes they will change the text they're copying in one way or another, and that's important in some way. Or they'll add something to the text, or they'll make a comment, or they'll write a footnote, almost what we would call a footnote. But remember, when the scribes are very highly trained, so because they didn't have printing, when you're handwriting a book, you have to use a very particular technique, and so you don't just scrawl your handwriting like we do. You write in a very particular way. You've been trained to form your letters and write in a very particular way. And so what we can tell from how they write is where they were trained and when they were trained.
Oh, cool. Huh.
So we look at a manuscript and say, okay, this is from the 1200s and from this particular monastery in France, because we know that that's how they train their scribes to form the letters.
Right. That's awesome. I was thinking, do the same guys that do the handwriting or who are doing the writing, are they also the same ones that in certain books decorate the edges?
Yep. Well, now, not always. Sometimes different authors will. So you'll have the text written by one scribe. Mm-hmm. Then you'll have the decorations put in by someone else. But often it's the same person.
Right.
Right.
Illustrations by. I guess that's.
That's another
thing for books over scrolls. If you mess up something in this great trained art of print and calligraphy, you don't have to replace the whole scroll. You just rip a page out and do that one.
Yeah, although ripping the page out is pretty expensive. Because it's parchment.
Right. Yeah.
And the thing about, actually, here's something else interesting, is that in the end of the 500s, you had a shift from papyrus to parchment. And so papyrus is stuff you ship in from Egypt or Sicily, made up of the reeds, and you press them together, and then it's cheaper. In parchment, you have to kill a bunch of sheep and goats and stretch the skin out and cure it and that kind of thing. So until the end of the 6th century, the end of the 500s, most people used parchment. So we have wills, so like legal texts from the period of the Merovingian Franks, who was the first big Frankish dynasty, French royal dynasty, from this period, and it's all in papyrus. Of course, the problem with papyrus is it rots very easily. well, not very easily, but it rots much more easily than the parchment, which does not rot. And right. so we don't have nearly as much of it as we would like.
Right.
So the dates, again, you said it was the end of the 500s to the end of the 600s, basically? That they
basically
used?
Mid-600s is okay. when you had the shift.
So it wasn't...
Yeah.
Huh. And then
go ahead, Dustin.
What came... What was after...
Wait. Okay, hang on. I got a question for this. Ben, can you do for us, can you do an idiot's guide of where, can you do the quick version of from, I know it's going to be a big jump, from Rome to the time of, let's say, gunpowder. Well, that depends. That's far back with China. But let's say until it was used, like cannon. Can you give us a quick timeline of that?
So just like sort of the big events, like sort of kind of what mm-hmm. what happened, as it were.
Yeah,
sure.
Okay, so the fall of Rome is the big date. There is 476, and the last emperor was deposed in the West. The East, of course, was still going on with the Byzantine Empire. And then you have in, I'll give you what happened in the area that we call France, I guess France, Belgium, Germany, that kind of thing, and Britain. You have the Merovingian Franks, who were in, who were from 450 to about 800, or 750 rather. And they had this big kingdom. And then in Italy, you had the Goths, who were conquered by the Romans, again, by the Byzantines reconquered Italy for a time. Anyway, there's a whole gaggle of barbarians there in Italy and that kind of area. But the Merovingian Franks until 750. And then you have the Carolingian dynasty in France from about 750 to 1000 or so, about that. And then, because what happened, and here's another easy date for you. Christmas Day 800 was when Charlemagne was crowned Emperor of the Romans. So, it's the easiest date in history. and then after the Carolingians, you had a number of other French dynasties like the Capetians and so on and so forth. So that's when you sort of have France was sort of always a main kingdom from about the middle of from the early part of the 6th century onward, was sort of one kingdom formally.
Right.
And then you have the Normans, who were subjects to the French king, but pretty independent too, from Normandy, conquering England in 1066, conquering it from the Anglo-Saxons, Angles of the Saxons, who had in turn migrated to Britain in the 500s. And then you have, moving on, and of course, there's always lots of British possessions in France from 1066 onwards. So that's why you have the Hundred Years' War,
right,
and Battle of Agincourt, and so on and so forth, because the British kings always had claims in France. So actually, you had the weird situation where you have the King of England is technically speaking a vassal of the King of France, but because he owns lands in France, and the whole sort of feudalism thing where he has to swear an oath of allegiance. But, and that's, of course, they didn't want to do that, so that's why you have the battles. So gunpowder came around about so we know there was cannons used at the Battle of Crecy in the 1300s, early 1300s, but not very much. It was mostly longbows still.
And there we are. So
that's very vague. And
No,
the Middle Ages is a very big period. Lots of stuff was going on.
The big Middle Ages. No, that's good. It gives us a little wrap our heads around a little bit. Someone interesting I was thinking of, Joan of Arc. That was in the Hundred Years' War. That was around that time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she's really, really young. Mm-hmm. And how does she, someone that young, get the French king, or at the time, right, you said the English had most of it, and her legacy was she won, a couple battles to help recrown the king in a certain area? It's just... Charles V, and then she, burnt at the stake at 19, was it?
Something like that, yeah.
So she had this this time from the time she was like 13 to 19, where she was the thing that brought the morale to the French troops, I guess. But she also, whether it was true or not, believed that God spoke to her, and that was that thing. She constantly, that was her thing, which is always a good thing back then, was God's speaking through me, so listen to me, trust me, I know. And she gets a few things right, and they're like, okay, but then didn't they turn her over towards the end? I know that's a bad recap of Joan of Arc, but you tell me.
Well, I'm not an expert in Joan of Arc, but remember, they weren't actually, this was a very rare and extraordinary thing. Usually when people say, God's told me this, people did not believe them. I mean, the Middle Ages was no more, I guess, what's the word? Credulous than we are in that sense. And so the fact that Joan the Maid, whatever, Jeanne la Poussin, said doing this stuff was, I guess, one of the more was sort of weird and remarkable events in history, that if basically if it didn't act, it's one of the things, history is weirder than fiction. And she did this, but yeah, I mean, she just, I guess, had a, it's difficult to explain beyond the fact that, yes, she had this tremendous charisma.
Right.
Had lots of followers and mobilized the French. Although Charles V, Charles the Wise, as he was known, had a lot to do with it as well. Because he had the excellent strategy of basically waiting the English out. She certainly was, it was a very big deal, and but I can't say a whole lot about her.
Yeah, no, that's more than I know. It's such a such a wild story.
I know.
It's very interesting. Yeah. So I wanted, I'm getting power spikes at my house. Well, this might end. And we're done, folks. 35 minutes.
I am too.
We'll have a Dustin and a Ben podcast. Yeah. I want to get into a bit of the making side of stuff, Ben. Yeah. We've done videos on Dustin made, we call it a longbow, but now I guess it's not traditionally a longbow. It's just a self bow.
Yeah, it's a flat bow.
And we just put out a video of Dustin making a pirate cutlass out of a machete. Now, the history, okay, we'll go into this first. So the history of the longbow and English having the longbow, can you tell us about that and what the advantage was? And they won a lot of battles because of it, right?
Well, they won the big ones. So, you know, a Cressy, what's the other one around the same time? I forget the one it's called, and then Agincourt. But really what happened is that the English kings and other leaders, like the Black Prince of Wales, Edward the Black Prince of Wales, had grasped sooner than their French counterparts, was that the knight by the 14th century was obsolete. Mm-hmm. So basically, and the French may have known this, but like many cases in history, they chose to ignore staring them in the face.
Right.
So basically, the longbow is not, in fact, a longer-ranged, better weapon than the crossbow. So the crossbow has a longer range. Now, so actually, at the Battle of Crecy, the French had crossbows, but they had hired a bunch of Genoese crossbowmen from the city of Genoa, that kind of thing, who were experts, you know, professional soldiers. And what you do with a crossbow, because crossbows took a much longer to load, is you would have these big shields on stands, like movable shields that they would hide behind, that they would shield behind while they were reloading. So what you'd do is you'd go out, put these shields out front, and the crossbowmen would be behind them, and then they'd pop out, fire volleys, and back in again. And so from a long enough range. So theoretically, The English longbowmen should not have been able to outrange and to mow down the French like they did. Mm-hmm. However, the longbow has the advantage that it fires much quickly, much more quickly. It was the machine gun of the era, basically.
Right, yeah.
And also much simpler construction, so there's fewer moving parts.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the longbow also took much more training to get right.
Right.
Because the crossbow, you just have to, there's not much to do. You know, you can actually have some people actually tried to have the crossbow banned as a weapon of war because it was too easy for a peasant to kill a knight.
Right.
The crossbow. Whereas a longbow, right,
yeah.
So I think it was Edward I and others who banned all sports on Sunday except for archery.
Right.
So that the people in the towns and the villages could all just train using the longbow, which took a long time to learn how to use properly.
Right.
So that's what they did. So the longbow was fired much more quickly. It was much simpler construction, but you had to learn, but it took much more training to use. Whereas the crossbows, much shorter training time, but much slower reload and fire rate. And so back to the Battle of Crecy and the Genoese crossbowmen, who again were experts and professionals. But the thing is, so they should have been able to outrange the crossbows, but they were sent out without their shields out in first front. And so the French leadership made a very stupid decision. And so the Genoese, seeing this, beat it because, you know, they're mercenaries. They knew they were being misused.
Yeah, right.
And so you say, well, you know, if you aren't using us correctly, we're not going to risk our lives for you for this kind of thing.
So they took off.
Took off. And then, of course, the French, you know, advance cavalry, but also just, you know, on foot and get mown down with the longbows. Right.
I'll say just I think, I guess as the English would say, they have just a lot more kit for a longbow, right? You need your crank, you need your bow, and it seems you need your shield. Right.
Yep.
And the longbow, they can just have their quiver and bow, and they're ready to go. But you do need a lifetime of training. But yeah, thinking of that constant, they can shoot so much more. They can dial in their shots.
Exactly,
right? Your first volley. Okay, we're 50 yards short. Now we know what to do. And then they can dial it in a lot quicker than a crossbow. That makes a lot of sense.
But the commanders, by the way, in archery would not say fire when they did so. Hmm. Sometimes in movies you'll hear them yelling out the commanders to the archers, fire. But of course, right. you don't need fire when you're shooting. That only applies to gunpowder.
So it's not a good thing for a bow. Right. It's loose. Is it loose?
Exactly. It's loose, or something like that.
Go ahead, Dust. Tell the big controversy around that for us.
So, for that video specifically, where I made the Osage flat bow, the self bow out of wood, I did. I think I said, like, all right, you know, I'm gonna fire this for the first time. And I've gotten so many comments from people who are like, you don't fire a bow, you shoot a bow.
It's like, I know.
That's funny you mentioned that, because I've gotten a lot of comments on people.
Just being
like,
pedantic,
you don't fire a bow,
I know.
It's not a gun.
We know what they meant, but true. It's still kind of fun.
Right.
But they wouldn't.
Ready, aim, fire. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. When you hear that, you're thinking about, like, you know, ready, aim, fire,
a gun. Yeah, because, of course, fire actually just means you have a burning, like in the old days of gunpowder, you had like a burning wick and you'd put it in the priming pan and then it'd go off. So put the fire to the gunpowder. But
that's fine. So if crossbows were used properly and a superior tool, less training, mm-hmm. harder to make, but less training. And if you had, you know, you have the right amount of training, you know, the professionals, and it's a superior mm-hmm. tool. So when there's this transition between when, you know, I guess archers from England and wherever would have been the superior war presence to the, then the transition to crossbows. So why is it similar things like the Battle of Cressy, where there are mistakes that happen, that the reason why the bow has this allure of being like the weapon of the time over the crossbow.
Well, because they're contemporary weapons of war. So right. They were used different times. Just that the British, again, the longbow fired more quickly. And so if you used it correctly, right. as generally speaking, the British did, then it wasn't a problem. And
right.
now at this time also, you have steel armor being introduced. Right. And or more steel, because you didn't have like I guess they call it carbonized iron initially.
Yep.
So I guess it would be full complete steel, but it'd be more carbonized iron, so better iron. So it'd be harder for arrows to penetrate it from range. They could penetrate it shorter range. Mm-hmm. So let's we can move forward to another battle with it, the Battle of Agincourt. And this was again much later than Cressy. And the thing is about Agincourt is the French really knew they were doing something stupid by going into the longbows. But the problem is the old wise heads who told them, do not go attack the British in this situation, were pushed aside by young, ardent men who decided to try to gain honor for themselves. It didn't work out. But the point is that in that case, the longbows were still used. They were still good. But they shouldn't have been successful. It's just that, again, the French made stupid mistakes. And Henry V, who was the British king who ran it, was a really, really, really smart warrior and backed them basically into the perfect terrain for being slaughtered. But what they did in that case was they walked. So they didn't, there was actually no cavalry charge in that case. They just, all the French men at arms in their steel armor. So it's sort of, at this point, you have the pinnacle of the most typical knights. You didn't have mail. It was all just steel plate and it was good, but they'd walk. So they walked, of course it was really muddy and they got bogged down. Eventually they walked. And then of course, having these showers of arrows coming at you, would be first distracting. So I remember I'm asking when a professor of mine in the UK, I said, would the steel stop the iron? I mean, wouldn't the steel stop the iron arrowheads? From a distance, do you think they would? So what he did was he threw a pen at me and said, how does that make you feel? Basically having this stuff come in, and of course it can still penetrate the eye holes and the chinks in the armor elsewhere.
Right.
And once you get close enough, it'll actually penetrate the steel itself. But it confused them. It also basically impeded them. It confused them. It disorganized them.
Yeah. Psychological warfare.
Right.
Like volleys and volleys of arrows falling.
Exactly.
Over. Yeah.
And so what they do is they go in and then disorganized, stuck in the mud. And then what happens is the archers put down their bows and ran around the sides because they also had these wooden stakes, sharpened wooden stakes they'd pound in beside them to stop a cavalry charge. And then they'd run out go around the sides of the big French column of men at arms and take, they said they had hammers and swords. They were unarmored. Mm. They were lightly, so it's better when you're walking around mud to be not have any armor on you.
Right.
So they take big hammers and like knives and swords and that kind of things. And individual men at arms who'd kind of fallen out of the press because they were this time really, it's like a crowd, like a big, like a crowd disaster when everyone's pushed together and smothered kind of thing. That was what's going on at Agincourt. Guys would sort of stagger out from the main press of the men at arms, and then they'd be tackled by three or four archers, crowding around them, and killing them that way.
There's a great. It's obviously not historical. A great episode in Game of Thrones. What was it? Season 6. Dust, have you watched it all?
Yeah.
Have you watched Game of Thrones, Ben?
I haven't actually.
Oh man. Oh. Well, anyway, there's this battle. You should watch it. The last season's not so good, but everything else is good.
So I heard.
There's a great battle that they get surrounded, and and pinned, and then they're all pushed together kind of in fear. And it's done so well where people are getting trampled and you're just getting pulled under and you're just laying there on top and there's screams. I can see how that's distracting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah. But so Agincourt, of course, was designed for that because it's the field is sort of like a funnel with woods on either side of you. And of course, what Henry V was aiming at. But
it's kind of like the modern tank. You feel great until you get bogged down, and then you're surrounded by a lot of angry people.
Exactly. It's like all the little guys with their
who are pissed off that you've had the advantage for so long, and they're like, "All right, now five of us are going to go after you, and you're going
to
be done."
We got a bunch of rockets and just get to that one,
right?
But but yeah, in this case, and then of course the French turned around and tried to walk back. Then the other waves were coming after them and got them into a further mess and more archer. Then the archers went back and picked their bows again. Anyway, it was
So I guess the longbow didn't get phased out until I guess the gun and the cannon. So they weren't equal, longbow and crossbow, but I guess they both had their advantages and disadvantages.
Right. Yeah, they did. And it depends how they were used again. And say in siege, for example, crossbows would be much better.
Right.
And again, they were very successful because, again, people tried to have them outlawed because it was, you know, a war crime to use a crossbow, apparently, because, you know.
But when you're under siege, anything goes, huh?
Not anything, only if you don't surrender.
I was thinking about that with, you were mentioning earlier about, one of the questions I had, sorry, was why were they not on horseback in the Battle of Agincourt? Why did the knights go in, like the cavalry go? Why would they not have been on horseback?
Because the English were behind sharpened stakes, and because of the mud.
Like in if the listeners, if you guys are familiar with Braveheart, the scene where all the horses are coming in and they lift up the stakes, right? That keeps the gotcha.
Okay. Cavalry charges happened more in imagination or fiction than in actual reality.
Right.
Gotcha. It's because again they're very easily stopped.
Right.
And again, you could do it, but by this point the armored knight was obsolete. Right. And
if you think about it, a lot of times unless you do it the last second, a horse will not run into a crowd of people like
they most people. Certainly will not.
Right. So they will stop whether you want to go in or not, you would think.
Yep. Yeah. There's actually an excellent description of this in a book I'm going to recommend at the end of this. But
teaser.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Nice. But, we were interested kind of like in your specialty, you said it's early Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. What would kind of, if you can kind of give us the day in the life of kind of a normal person, or maybe even like a soldier, right? If they're in a battle, like how would that look? I know we've kind of gone over a little bit, like how things would happen, but you get this, like all the tactics and the setup and you got to draw people in, but what would the normal day in the life of a warrior be, or a soldier be, where you would like getting prepared, would all the gear, would it be your own gear? Would it be, you know, something that's in a barracks you'd have to go and pick up? Do you know that enough to kind of go through that some with us?
Well, I can't, we don't have a lot of descriptions of the day in the life of of ordinary people. So by early Middle Ages, I'm actually talking about late antiquity, which is also, early Middle Ages is different from late antiquity. It's sort of Charlemagne, whereas late antiquity is fall of Rome kind of thing. But so Roman soldiers from the late empire had their equipment assigned to them by the state. So it was provided for them. But later on in Europe, if you were a warrior, you provided your own arms and armor. So this is one of the reasons why soldiers and people in feudal armies and whatnot were usually from the upper and middle classes.
Right.
Because you could afford your armor. Same thing with ancient Greece.
Right.
All people who fought in war were from the upper classes. The lower classes did not fight. Until, of course, later on, when sort of you had like big states like Athens conscripted lower class people and gave them like a state issued armor. But the point is, so I can give you a day in the life of a king.
Sure.
If you like. Yeah. Specifically, yeah. We have a description of the day of King Theodoric the Great, who was the first or the second Gothic king after the fall of the Roman Empire.
So what would that time period?
It would be 490 to 520, thereabouts, okay. Circa. Yeah.
Gotcha.
So he would get up in the morning and have breakfast, and then he would do work. So he would respond to letters and that sort of thing initially.
Is that do work as code for go to the bathroom?
Well, yeah, I suppose that's it. They don't mention that actually for some reason.
Real quick. What's the this is my ignorance here, but what is it? There was a king known, an English king, for having people around as he went. Oh, was it John? Because he went to the bathroom a lot. What was the king? He would relieve himself while like at court.
Maybe. Well, there's a story that the French king Louis the 14th would always be attended by nobles wherever he went, whatever he did. Teeth them under his thumb.
That's one way to do it.
No, I mean, they were always attended. I mean, the thing about Europe was everyone who was anybody had tons of servants because labor was cheap, which is not the case in the East, actually, where labor was more expensive. So go up, answer letters, do paperwork, essentially, first start of the day. And then he would have the main meal of the day, which would be in the middle of the day. And he'd have sort of any important people who were visiting, he would be with them. He would meet them and talk to them. And then he would play dice.
Nice.
And gamble for the few hours in the afternoon.
As long as he kept winning.
If you wanted, if you were a diplomat visiting him and you wanted to have a good answer, you made sure he won.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course, it's dice. So sometimes he would cheat, but other times if he was in a good mood or a bad mood based on how the dice went. And then he would have audiences with the visiting dignitaries or petitioners or what have you and talk to things. And then that would be it, basically. So basically that's sort of the public part of the day. In terms of other stuff, say a soldier, it's difficult to say. I mean, you would, I don't know, actually. aren't really told because they didn't tell us what happened to the common people. We knew what a monk did.
Right.
Because we have text describing the exact layout of a monk's day, which involved lots and lots of prayers and saying the psalms and a few hours of labor and reading and that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. Once gunpowder comes along, now that's a huge big change. And for a while it was not a great war weapon because they didn't have it perfected. But once it did, I know a lot of people think or thought at the time that was maybe, along with crossbows, the end to some type of noble battle. But do you think that's the thing? I mean, was battle ever really noble, right? You can do a lot of nasty things in war, obviously. Everything's right, fair and love and war. Yeah. So it was that the end once a gunpowder came along? Was that the end of noble war?
No, it was not. Very much not. What gunpowder did was the first thing it did was it made armor obsolete. And so you could have much bigger armies with simple gunpowder weapons, although you still have to have a strong noble contingent. These cavalry, generally speaking, had to be from the nobility because they had to be able to afford their own horses.
Right.
So actually, don't forget, in the 19th century, during the Napoleonic Wars, the nobility had a very big role to play in war. I mean, the soldiers were all commoners. I think it was the Duke of Wellington who said that the men he commanded were mostly the very scum of the earth or what have you. which, given how they behaved after Battle of Waterloo, what they did to the French civilians once was not entirely false. Of course, armies are, unfortunately, have that tendency.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine being being in this gigantic horde of pouring out of testosterone.
Yep.
what does that result afterward?
When you've been under very heavy discipline, suddenly it's lifted.
Yeah.
Right. We see what obviously like mobs do. It's just an army is just another mob after they've been done killing. So they're ready. And they know they're also going to march off to battle the next day. So it's almost anything goes. Cause why not?
Well, not the next day. If it's battle the next day, they'll be kept under discipline. When they've won, that the problem comes.
All right, so if you get a free weekend, you really let loose.
Oh yeah, definitely. lots and lots of drink, for sure. But actually, what's interesting, back to the gunpowder thing. So basically, they had like cannon in the 1400s. So again, at Cressy, in the Battle of Cressy, they found a couple of stone cannonballs from the field, archaeologists.
Oh, wow. Huh.
But again, they would not have played a huge role because they didn't have enough of them and they didn't. They just weren't as effective enough to do it. But by the time you get into the later part of the 15th century, and actually by the end of the Hundred Years' War, you had gunpowder much more in use, and the best users of it were the French. So actually the best soldiers in Europe from the 15th century onward were the French. Mm. And so actually Richard III, the King of England, you know, the guy who's the hunchback, the kind of who, you know, usurped the throne kind of thing, was defeated by Henry VII, who came and conquered him. You know, my kingdom for a horse, that whole scene kind of thing.
Right.
Who had quite a few French soldiers in his army because they were the best professionals of the time.
Oh.
And they knew how to use gunpowder and they knew very well and they were very good at it. So once you learn how to use that stuff, you kind of get an edge over everyone else.
Yeah. And then you kind of have, that's the end of castles, right? Cannon?
No. You have to change the kind of fortification you make.
Right.
Castles were never foolproof anyway, because if you could, you could always besiege them long enough or storm them.
Right.
Because fortifications are never sort of, they're always sort of a delaying thing. They're not a panacea.
Right.
But you have to change the kind of fortifications you have. You still have massive fortifications built in throughout up until the 20th century. Remember the Maginot Line?
Right.
That's a big castle in the First World War.
Yeah. That they went right through that one.
Well, they went around it, but yes, what happens. But yeah, you still have fortifications, but they have to be changed a lot. And obviously, you can't depend on them anymore because you have a cannon can obviously get through them much more easily. Right. So the fall of Constantinople in 1453 happened because the Ottomans hired German bombardiers who were able just to get rid of to batter down the walls very easily. But the real change happens. Obviously, that does spell the end of one kind of fortification. But then what you have is the lighter field guns, so the musketeers,
right,
and arquebuses, which are an early kind of musket.
Yeah, what's that?
An arquebus?
Yeah.
It's a matchlock musket kind of thing. It's an early kind of musket.
Gotcha.
And... but actually, with the arquebuses, you had to have pikemen defending them because it took too long to reload. So, and actually, you had a shift. So initially, you don't have all gunpowder armies. You have half gunpowder, half pikemen.
Right.
So in the English Civil War, like Oliver Cromwell and company, they had that kind of mix of musketeers and... Pikemen.
I feel like that's a good gig in an army, the pikemen.
Yeah. Right?
You're kind of defensive. You're hanging out. If they come, we'll start. Or you guys shoot, we'll hang here, hang low.
Yeah, that can work. Although if they start shooting at you, you kind of. They're the good defensive. They're good in certain cases. So actually, in later Middle Ages and early Renaissance, you had a number of very prominent pike armies, like the Scottish were one, you know, the whole William Wallace thing. That was very much the Siltrons, the Skiltrons of pikes. And then you also have the Swiss, who were very good with pikes and could actually attack with pikes, which is very unique at the time. But again, they were eventually squashed by other armies who mixed arms better.
Right.
Because pikes are sort of they're good in certain times and places, but not others.
Yeah, right. They're fun until people get close range. Then you're like, I had my fun.
Yeah.
So. I poke from afar until they get past. Then, we try.
Exactly. When you eventually figure out that cavalry charges are a bad idea.
Right.
I
was thinking about. So you have something like the Hundred Years' War. Did they have a lot of time for sport, or was warring, was that their sport?
Training for it was their sport. But actually what they did, remember, the Hundred Years' War had lots of breaks in it. So you had a number of long periods of peace in the middle of it. Hundred Years' War is kind of a myth. But it's a useful term to describe something that went on there.
Right.
Most of the time, but it was pretty destructive all the same, with marauding bands of unpaid soldiers running around. It's one of the reasons that Joan of Arc was so latched onto is because the common people were not in a good mood having to defend themselves from mercenaries.
They just needed a lady around to lighten things up.
Well, they needed someone who had a message from God.
Well, there you go.
That'll help.
She did. And how old is she? Don't worry about it.
That's right. No, she's young and innocent, and therefore, definitely.
Right. Definitely. Anyway, she gets the direct line.
Yeah. Although you read some of Shakespeare's plays, she's held as some sort of vile witch. So there you go.
English would think that.
Oh, they would indeed. That's why they burnt her. But what was the question again?
I was saying the sport was
the sports,
was warring the sport, or
well, no, what hunting.
Mm.
The upper classes hunted and falcons, so falconry and hunting and hunting the wild boar or hunting deer or going after birds with your falcon kind of thing. Mm. That was big, but that was very popular. Right. So that was their sport.
Yeah.
And leisure.
And I guess still that
leads us back.
That's a little bit of training too.
Yeah,
it is training.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's also fun.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Back to the original quote right here. Speak German to your horse. That's why I was like, well, that's all part of that, hunting and the business of war.
There you go.
Right. And after all that, we've talked about it before, Ben, once everyone comes over to the Americas and starts colonizing the going back to kind of the old school warfare, right? When all the settlers were getting schooled by people on horseback with bows because they thought they were past all that, right? They're like, okay, we're done. We know how to do it. Civilized. We'll line up. And Native Americans would just circle around and let loose 100 shots and,
well, that's the old story of guerrilla, of irregular warfare, of guerrilla wars, warriors being problems for people who are used to fighting big conventional war.
Mm-hmm.
Noble warfare as opposed to...
Yeah, but eventually that happens warfare. In a lot of places. Same thing with, another big shift, for example, was when the Mongols invaded Europe. In Eastern Europe, they were unused to dealing with the kind of warfare the Mongols did, on horseback, archery kind of thing. So they had to shift. So what you eventually do is adopt the tactics of your enemies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. That's how the Texas Rangers eventually started to do okay.
That's right. Yeah.
They had to adopt the same tactics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I wanted to ask you... About a premise to this question is that one of the book series that I love is a series called Dies the Fire. Mm-hmm. It's all about a post-apocalyptic world where there's an event that happens. It kills all gunpowder and all electricity. So it sets us all back to pre-electricity and gunpowder. Mm-hmm. So it's all, you know, medieval-style warfare. And this happens, the event happens in the book in, I think it's 96 or 98 or something like that. So at the time, the story follows a few different people's, you know, kind of plot. But one of the main guys is a medieval, I think he's like a 13th century history teacher in Portland. And he takes over Portland. He's the antagonist of the story. But he is part of, and they reference a lot of in this book, they reference the SCA, Society for Creative Anachronisms. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, as like a historian, what's your take on the SCA? Or if you, are you like, do you know people who are in it? Are you part of it? Or is, I'm curious.
I know nothing about it, I have to say.
Really? Huh. Okay.
Society of Creative Anachronism. I think I've heard of it, but I, right. Yeah. So there are, it means for the broader subject here of people who sort of like reenactors or people who do things like restoring, right. like medieval crafts or war.
Yeah.
There are lots of groups that kind of do that. Something called like medieval martial arts, for example, I've seen advertised.
Right. Yeah.
And I did see some reenactors last year. I was at a conference and, so academic medieval studies conferences are always, as I say, big ones at least, are half academic conference, half Comic Con.
And yeah, exactly.
Which, I mean, they have medieval knight reenactors come, and so like, right. So like medieval hand to hand combat, or you know, here's a blacksmith, a medieval blacksmith demonstration, or that sort of thing.
Right.
So I know people do that.
Right.
Thing is, scholars like me, we'll deal mostly with books and writing. So we'd be pretty useless in a post-apocalyptic world, I have to say, apart from, you know, any other skills we have apart from that. So.
You have right. Do you have a lot of, like,
your brain,
Renaissance festivals up there, up around you in Canada?
Maybe. I don't think so. I haven't been to one. The only stuff I've been to has been either in the States or in Europe. I know there are a few. But.
Yeah, I like that though. I didn't realize, like you said, when there's kind of medieval conferences and things, and sometimes they'll bring in reenactments to just have that, like the real, you know, the hands-on experience there. And I would imagine that those reenactments are probably, I would hope, much more realistic to what would have actually been happening at the time, you know, as opposed to the Renaissance Festival.
Oh, yeah, very much so, yeah.
Medieval times.
Yeah, so you have experts come in and say, these guys are not, they're not, they're like people who've studied carefully, like the old fighting manuals, like what you have from the Middle Ages saying, here's sword fighting instruction manuals. And they follow them very carefully and say it, because, you know, so it, you can find YouTube videos about this that are very interesting, actually. So,
yeah, there's a good, I've referenced it before. There's a Modern History TV. He does a lot of that. He's an English guy. I think he made his wealth in video games, so that gives him time to just play. But he's also really interested in the history, so they'll sit there and read copies of manuscripts. Mm-hmm. Try to figure out how they would do it, and then he gets his horse out and the stuff, and they go and try. It's a really good channel, but
yeah, definitely
a great watch.
Yeah, so I mean, there are ways of thinking about doing this, but it's just the idea that a medieval historian would be able to do that is a little far-fetched to me. I mean. I'm sure there are some who could. Maybe there are some who could. I mean, I don't know anybody who does this.
Well, but, I mean, I love the story because it's fun and fanciful.
Oh, yeah.
It's a post-apocalyptic story, which I love.
Those are always
but
fun things.
There are way too many perfect, like, circumstances that happen in the story. It's definitely, it's like, there, you know, there's this one group, and then they just happen upon someone who has training in sword fighting. So then they bring that person in, and then they just happen to come across a person who, like, has all this history and training in bow making, and so they bring that person in, and it's like, you know, it's just too many like perfect circumstances in the book, but it makes for a fun read.
Right.
It makes for
it's a good story.
They build this really interesting world, and I really like that too because they're taking their knowledge of current day technology, as much as they can still use like hydraulics and warfare and infrastructure, and using all of our current skills and technology, and then combining it with medieval technology, like building.
Medieval technology concrete. Was pretty good at times. So I'll say this, that the end of the Roman Empire, there was a reduction in a lot of technology. Although not agricultural technology, so they still have the same level of very advanced plow, for example, in the early Middle Ages, which would be a kind of a horse-drawn, wheeled with wheels kind of plow, quite advanced. But by the end of the Middle Ages, their technology was far in advance of the Roman Empire. So
you said far advanced?
Far in advance, yeah.
Right.
They had far surpassed them. Yeah. So.
Right.
Yeah. Well, wasn't there a time, Ben, where you basically have a big chunk of history where they're kind of looking up at the aqueducts, figuring out like what kind of amazing people made this.
Not on the continent. No.
No.
Just thinking what you're thinking about is the Anglo-Saxons in England, who came in. They actually have some poems of the ruins. They were giants' ruins, kind of thing.
Right.
But those are the Anglo-Saxons who came in, and they who were not from Roman civilization.
Right.
And who solves up and wondering how did they do this kind of thing. But people on the continent were more concerned with where can we find the money to repair this thing? Which frequently they couldn't, and so they couldn't see this. That's why they fell into disrepair.
Right. They said, hey dummies, let's fix it, and then they got slaughtered. Well, yeah, we'll just kill you. How about that?
Yeah, well, that'll work. But no. They knew. I mean, it was part of it was just you didn't have the money to build those kind of things anymore. And so
You needed the slave labor, right?
Well, not slave labor, no, just gold. Yeah. You had plenty of, you may have plenty of slaves, but don't forget it takes highly skilled craftsmen. You don't actually have that many slaves around at this point in time. Hmm. And the peasants who you did have under your command didn't know how to do it. And so you have to actually hire people, and they were quite expensive.
Really expensive slaves.
Maybe.
But, sure.
But generally speaking, it was free men who you had to pay a lot of money to. And why do that when you can do other things instead? So.
Well, it's... if we could like take a time and information that would make Devin and I seem incredibly uneducated compared to you, this has been a perfect podcast for that. But I love, it's such a fascinating time period and such a fascinating, I mean, just like, you know, your knowledge of these years and this transition between, like you said, the fall of Rome and then modern, you know, I guess it goes well, Roman times, and then you have Middle Ages, and then...
Middle Ages is about 500 to 1500, we say.
Okay.
About 1,000 years, which is a long time. And so, I mean, it's just, you know, stuff. But, I mean, history is just so big and so complicated. So much is going on. I mean,
Right. I mean,
you can never get to the end of it.
Yeah, there's so much to go over. We're going to have you on again and do a whole just, like, we'll do a weapons podcast.
Sure.
And just go down the line and do every type of weapon. We'll go from the stick to the cannon. And just,
there you go.
All right.
It's like, man, I gotta get a few more PhDs to do all that.
Well, I'm gonna come next time. I'm gonna YouTube really hard, and I'm gonna come in and throw some facts at you.
Well, military history people do a lot of this kind of thing. Military historians, and I listen to a couple of their presentations. It can either be very, very interesting or very, very boring.
Right.
Because they kind of go into here's how many pounds of of fodder you can carry on this horse, and therefore this people at this point in time.
Right.
Cool. You're like, but who did they murder? Start with that.
And yes, then we'll just talk tell about me what that. Actually happened. Right. I don't want to hear about, you know, how many inches of pollen you found in this cave.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
But well, usually they're very interested.
There's good history teachers and bad history teachers.
Yeah.
So we want to do. Actually, you know what? Ben, can you give us, normally we ask a disaster story from a maker, something that went really wrong. Do you have a good, I mean, we've heard a few of them already, but a good history disaster story? Put you on the spot.
Yes, I can. I'll tell you about, one of the people I study is an historian called Gregory of Tours. He wrote in the late 6th century, so late 500s. And he loves telling about disasters happening to hapless people, sort of showing how foolish people are, sort of one of his things. So I'll tell you a disaster that befell. So two Merovingian lords were fighting each other. And one was coming from the king. The other was fighting against the king. Excuse me. The guy who was fighting against the king was called Mummolanus, and he was holed up in a city, in a walled city. And this other guy who was coming after him, Guntram, was leading his army, and the city was surrounded by a river. And so Guntram, who led the army from the king against the rebel Mummolanus, or I should say Mummolus, said to Mummolus, "Let us across, and you know, I'll beat you and across there," kind of thing. Mummolus said, "Come over, so cross the river." So Guntram led his army across, started to lead his army across the river, but Mummolus had dug pits in the river with spikes in them, and so many of Guntram's army got drowned and or skewered on their way over. So had to retreat. So that's kind of this is a disaster story for you. It's actually, it's kind of played for laughs, actually, in the history.
Right.
Wouldn't have been very funny at the time, but yeah.
That's great. I love that one of the scribes that you've researched specifically likes, you know, telling disasters and things, things that have befallen different, characters from history.
That's right.
Well, that's good. Yeah, come on. That's good reading, right?
Yeah,
it would be. Yeah, I mean, some of it's quite funny.
That's great. All right. Well, this has been fascinating. I'm super, pumped and appreciated that you have come and joined us today, Ben. This is so much fun, and like Devin said, we need to pick your brain some more about, all sorts of stuff, but we'd love to go through the history of weapons and things since we love to.
Thanks for having me, guys. It was a lot of fun.
It is fun. You're now going to be our resident historian.
Okay.
Yeah. So we'll have you come in. And
have you on. We'll have you pop in for a minute.
We'll have you clear up. Devin, actually, there wasn't many slaves. Well,
Well, there were a few slaves.
There's a few. There's got to be a few around, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say recommendations. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the book talks about this kind of very interesting. It's a book called "The Face of Battle" by a man named John Keegan. Okay. "The Face of Battle" by John Keegan.
Go on.
It's a book that looks at three battles: Battle of Agincourt, the Battle of Waterloo, and the Battle of the Somme.
Yeah.
First World War. It looks at what exactly happened during the battle. Mm. Like how did cavalry, what did horses actually do? Did horses actually charge? Ranks of bayonets.
Are those three battles compared?
Yep, they are compared. But they're basically the experience of the individual soldier is compared in each of them.
Mm.
Oh, man,
he's asking, awesome. What actually is cool. Actual battle like?
Right.
Yeah,
it's not.
And it's an older book. It's a classic that is so much fun to read, and you just learn so much about people and about history and about like weapons and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Awesome. That's awesome. I'm gonna go on Amazon and buy it.
Heck yeah. That's great. It sounds so cool.
To go with that, I'll do mine. It's Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. Since we're talking about history stuff today, he's just so good. He has a podcast. It's called Hardcore History. He has a bunch for free that you can get wherever you get your normal podcasts, but he has some that you can buy, but they're definitely worth it because he goes in depth. He's just a great historian. He did an awesome series on World War. Oh, he's done a bunch, the cons and World War One and World War Two, but it's called The Apocalypse. Anyway, he does a great one on World War One. We'll leave the link in the description below. But great historian, really entertaining. He's got a good good story voice.
Nice.
Sounds good.
My recommendation for the week has really nothing to do with medieval history, except for the fact that it is a person who works with knives. there's a this guy's name. His Instagram handle is at the Topicala, TOPICALA. And he's also on YouTube as the Topicala. I don't know exactly where he's from. I think it's somewhere in the Sweden, Finland, that area. I'm not exactly sure, but I've been watching him for a couple of years. What he really focuses on is handle sculpting and making handles for knives. So he's not a knife maker, but he'll take knives, he'll get knife blanks, and he'll do the handle, which is fascinating to me because he's done a lot of these handles. He has a fairly simple setup to make the handles that he does, but beautiful things. He always does videos of his work, and he'll do commissions for people and stuff. But just I think to me one of the reasons why I like it is kind of it goes back to the way a craftsperson would have maybe worked before this kind of modern resurgence of craft where someone's doing everything. It kind of leads back to like there'd be a blacksmith that would make the steel or the iron, and then there would be other people who did different things, right? He would have been like the woodworker or the handle maker, right? So he might have been he had that specialty. So he does handles for knives, and he does beautiful work. And so that's my recommendation, the Topicala.
Nice.
You can find him on YouTube and Instagram.
There you go. I have the name Blueprint for Armageddon was the series that I read. I listened to it. It's probably 10 or 11 hours long. I think that one's for free. This is the synopsis. The planet hasn't seen a major war between all the great powers since the downfall of Napoleon at Waterloo in 1815. But 99 years later, the dam breaks and Pandora's box of violence engulfs the planet.
Nice.
sounds exciting.
It's really
good. Yes, it does.
Must have been a heck of a war.
Whole bunch of nastiness happens after that.
Yeah.
So is that a you said it's a podcast?
It is a podcast. Story, he has a bunch of them. You can get them for free, like a normal podcast, but he also put them out as stuff you can buy. They're like a buck each. They're definitely worth it.
Right.
And, you can listen to 10 hours of anything, any subject he goes into. He goes in depth, and it's really good.
Awesome. All right, everybody. Well, Ben, thank you so much for joining us today. This was fun and fascinating. And like I said before, just kind of blow my mind with, the stories, the things that and that the specificity of that time period. So thanks everybody so much for watching. You can find us on YouTube at The Art of Craftsmanship. You can also follow us on Instagram at at The Art of Craftsmanship. And then if you want to find another way to support us for The Art of Craftsmanship, you can go over to Patreon and support us there. Ben, is there any social media that you do that you want people to follow you, or anything specific that you want to
see? No, I don't. Or... at least not at this point.
Gotcha. But you are working on some books.
I am working on a couple of books, but awesome. They are not They're specialist books, so they're not
gotcha
at this point.
Right. So then forget it.
Well, they're very like very expensive. They will be very expensive and mostly bought by libraries. So
gotcha.
I relate to something else eventually, but
yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, everybody, for listening. This has been fun. We will put the information in the show notes below for all the recommendations and where you can follow us. And you could also please go over to the Makery Network if you're not already there and check out all the other podcasters on the network. We have a really awesome group of people who are doing really cool things that it's all about making and, you know, the mentality behind it and how we all do this craft that we love. So thanks everybody so much for listening, and we will talk to you next time.
If you like this show, take a look at our other shows made for makers just like you at www.makery.network.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.